Fostering Creativity in the Arts, the Workplace, and Life. Creativity is one of those things that you know it when you see it, but can be difficult to explain how or why it happens. For some, creativity is just part of their job. Think of a jazz musician or a painter. But we find creativity in the workplace as well. The accountant who comes up with a novel way to interpret a balance sheet, or a software engineer who discovers the latest and greatest app. I'm Suzanne Nance, and today we are going to talk about the intersection of creativity, the arts, science, and the world of business. With me in the studio, Jennifer Torrance. She's Senior Manager of Multimedia Services at the Jackson Laboratory. She's also a singer and driving force behind the lab's Right Brain Cafe, which we'll learn more about in a minute. David Shaw's career has combined business leadership, government, and community service, strategy consulting, and investment management. Shaw is the founder of IDEX Laboratories, among many other businesses. He's also a life trustee at the Jackson Laboratory and a former chair of its board. And joining us from his office in Baltimore is Dr. Charles Lim. He's an associate professor of otolaryngology at the Johns Hopkins University. He's also on the faculty at the Peabody Conservatory of Music. Of course, we want you to be a part of this conversation. Are you the creative type? If so, what helps you get creative? Share your comments. Email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @maincalling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call. 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. The importance of creativity to the arts, the business world, and life. This is Main Calling.
Broadcast of Main Calling is made possible by MPBN listener contributions and by Main Health, a family of healthcare organizations working together to make Maine communities the healthiest in America. Learn more at mainehealth.org.
And welcome to Maine Calling. David Shaw, last year, you and your wife, actress Glenn Close, were awarded the first ever Maine Creative Industries Award. And you were honored for your, quote, extraordinary ability to blend creativity in art and business. So let's dive into the conversation and talk about creativity in business first. What do you see as the benefits of incorporating and furthermore promoting creativity in the workplace?
Well, there's so many benefits. I happen to have spent my good part of my life in high technology businesses, which are very disruptive. So you're using amazing new technology to offer benefits to the world over the way things were done. And in that world, Suzanne, good is the enemy of great. Using all of that great technology to merely produce good products or services isn't enough. It doesn't pay off the value of those technologies. And so, pushing yourself to be great and to believe that the conventional wisdom is wrong and to be disruptive takes a lot of creativity. So you have to push yourself, and teams have to push themselves to do really extraordinary things. And that takes multidisciplinary conversations. It takes a view that the conventional wisdom is wrong and looking for new and creative ways to do things every day.
And when you're looking at people to come on board to a business or an endeavor, are you purposefully looking at someone who is creative? When you bring them onto your team, would that be something that would be really important to you?
Sure. I think you and I have talked about this. Someone once said of Steve Jobs that he had the mind of an engineer and the heart of an artist. And that way of thinking about people or looking for those quality in people so that they have an artistic view of value creation and of bringing new perspectives to thing and so forth. Yes, that's very important in whether it's a nonprofit organizations, which we'll hear about, like Jackson Labs or for-profit businesses.
Can you give any examples of creativity at its best? And we'll talk more about this as the time wears on. But David, when a creative idea seemed crazy at first but turned into a huge success, it can often be a big surprise. Do you have any examples of this?
Sure. One that I'm involved in right now is we all know that the world's oil supplies, petroleum supplies, are being depleted, and we worry about that, of course. And so these are hydrocarbon molecules that were made over tens of thousands or millions of years by decaying algae. And we said to ourselves, a group of us said to ourselves, why can't we grow petroleum in real time? Why can't we make those hydrocarbons and replenish those hydrocarbons in real time? We are now making hydrocarbons in 2 weeks. So we are now growing hydrocarbons. And that audacious idea, and I could give you many other examples, but it's that kind of audacious idea where there's no pathway and you have to think of new ways of doing things that often drives the creativity of high-tech businesses.
Yeah, that's terrific. David Shaw is no stranger to the Jackson Laboratory here in Maine, having served as its chair, where Jennifer Torrance is the senior manager of multimedia services and also an accomplished singer. So, Jennifer, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You also play a significant role in what has become known as the Right Brain Cafe. And David Shaw was actually the person who informed me about such goings on at the Jackson Laboratory. So please tell us, what is the Right Brain Cafe? How did it start? And what's happening now?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think it was funny when you did your introduction that you referred to me as a driving force. It's more like I struck a match, actually. the Right Brain Cafe started over lunch. A friend of mine who's a fellow singer, her name is Heidi Stanton-Drew. She's a fellow employee. She and I were having lunch, and we were talking about how difficult it is for us as musicians to integrate or to find time for music in our very busy lives. So we had talked on and off about getting together and singing, and it never really happened. And we had this idea for the Right Brain Cafe, which does not serve food. It is food for your brain. And we had talked about starting something. We knew that there were a lot of other musicians at the laboratory that probably had the same challenges fitting music into their lives that we did. And it really wasn't until Ed Liu, our new director, arrived in January of 2012, that he gave us the excitement and the energy that we needed to start this thing. It is a two-hour block of time once a month where we have a time and a place, and really that's the only boundary. It is anyone can come. It is mostly advertised by word of mouth. The folks who tend to come are musicians because we're sort of the more gregarious bunch. We've had writers, we've had photographers, we've had art exhibits. We haven't had any dancers yet, but we hope. And every session is different, and it is an incredible community builder. Everyone from production staff right up through the director himself, and in some cases board members, participate in these sessions, and everyone is equal, and it's just a really exciting couple hours that serves as a point in time for people to prepare for. So we have a lot of people that do collaborative work in the intervening weeks to get ready for the next session. So
you mentioned that, you know, there are many people wanting this outlet for creativity that they already knew they possessed. What about the people who have sort of attended the Right Brain Cafe and discovered within themselves that they'd like to participate or try something new? And then how is it translated into the workplace?
We've had a lot of that happen. You know, people who, there's many people who are learning instruments on their own or who are aspiring writers. And attending Right Brain Cafe has, they'll often attend for 4 or 5 sessions before they even think about getting up and doing anything in front of others. It's very inspiring for people. They tend to take that inspiration home with them and continue to develop their own art. And they form relationships with others. So we've had a little group of writers that are getting together on their own. And we have one writer in particular who started working collaboratively with a pianist to use some music with her writing. In terms of how it's affected the work environment, it's really building community. You know, people are meeting people that they work with every day, day in, day out. They're meeting them as people and not just as the people that they work next to. I can give you an example. I've been at the laboratory for 17 years now, and five doors down from me is a science writer named Stephen Sampson. And Stephen, in the past year and a half, I have learned, used to be the staff accompanist for the Boston Lyric Opera. Well, I'm an opera singer, and so this is like heaven, right? We get together, and we're going to be planning a recital, and you know, there's all this collaboration that happens. But that then, I often have an opportunity to interact with Stephen professionally through some of the science writing and the graphic design that I do. And it has, our relationship through music has been completely altered in the work relationship. So now we have a much better rapport. It's easier to work together. And we see that all over campus. One of the most important things that I think has happened is the breaking down of hierarchies. Now when people see our director in the hallway, if they've attended a Right Brain Cafe or they've participated and played jazz with him, it's breaking down barriers that are really artificially created through a natural, you know, through a hierarchical environment in business. So arts, the arts really break down those barriers and allow people to communicate as human beings and not as their role.
Yeah, David Shaw, with your business hat on and, you know, you've been CEO, president, director, how would you see something like the Right Brain Cafe affecting productivity?
It's a great question, and I agree with what Jenna said here. I think unleashing creativity often has a lot to do with breaking down inhibitions and barriers, as you say. People need to know that they can speak up and not have their maybe unconventional points of view, which can be creative points of view, thought of as foolish. So you have to trust your colleagues. You have to be willing to introduce a minority or a dissenting opinion. And often in the world, and there are many famous stories about this in creativity, it's that new idea. It's that unconventional idea. It's the idea that seemed foolish that is the case cracker. Albert Einstein said, if at first the idea is not absurd, there's no hope for it.
That's perfect. Well, let's bring Dr. Charles Lim into the conversation. He's on the phone with us from Johns Hopkins University. Thanks for joining us this morning, Dr. Lim.
Thank you for having me.
You have studied the brain and creativity, specifically the brain on improv. And I'm curious, what was the motivation for you to conduct this kind of research?
Sure. Thank you for asking. So I have been actually a lifelong musician myself, a saxophonist and I'm playing a lot of jazz. And so that background in music kind of evolved into a deep obsession with sound, which ultimately led me to become a hearing specialist and has kind of fueled my entire career in medicine and science to some extent. So once I was in this field of medicine and this world of science, I started going back to my musical roots and thinking not just about music as entertainment, but music as a tool to understand the brain. I was also thinking about this idea that when a person is creative or the brains of creative individuals are, when they're doing what they do, that it must be biologically identifiable. And what I mean by that is there has to be a way to measure what's happening in the human brain. We have all these remarkable tools to study behavior, so why can't we apply it to things like artistic creation?
And what have you found?
Well, it's been several years in the making, about a decade of work now, where we've been looking at the brains of professional musicians and other artists as they create. And so it's been, first of all, I think I want to point out that these kinds of behaviors, as kind of mystical and intriguing as they are measurable, meaning that we can, if we do it in a respectful, appropriate way that's kind of artistically relevant, we can simulate an artistic context that is meaningful and take measurements of the brain. So that, I think, is the first thing that I think needs to be stated because, you know, if I were an artist listening to this, the first thing I would want to make sure is that somebody's findings are actually related to what I do, that there's some reality to it. Now, we found massive changes in the brain. It's a little hard to summarize in one sentence, but let me say this much. The prefrontal cortex of the brain, which is the part of the brain that really makes us human, undergoes some pretty dramatic changes in improvisation. And so to make a long story short, when your brain switches, or when the brain of a high-level artist switches from a memorized, pre-learned mode into a creative, improvised mode, the prefrontal cortex is having these autobiographical areas turn on where these self-censoring, self-monitoring areas are being suppressed. And so it's sort of like the brain is priming itself to, in a way, generate ideas, but also to allow itself to make a mistake in the pursuit of this higher goal that is usually driven to some extent by a person's own life, their own story.
Mm-hmm. I was really interested in, when I was watching your TED talk, Dr. Lim, when you mentioned that some of the activity you saw was in the language area of the brain. And I immediately thought to myself, that saying, if you don't use it, you lose it, right? So I was curious to ask you this question. What are the benefits of using that part of the brain and exercising that part of the brain in other aspects of our life? So in language and creative expression.
Sure. So one of the intriguing findings we've discovered is that when musicians are having a spontaneous musical conversation, meaning that no words are being exchanged, just music, but it's a spontaneous interplay, that traditional language areas of the brain are lighting up. And that's a really kind of neat idea, that our brain is using language areas to engage in musical dialogue. Part of the reason why that's intriguing is because of this idea that music is a universal language. Now, more to your point about this idea of use and disuse and atrophy, there's this idea that the brain, even though it's not a muscle, so like you're not working it the way you work your muscles in the gym. On the other hand, the brain responds to training because it has something called plasticity. And by plasticity, I mean that the brain reacts to patterns and stimuli over time in a form of learning so that it functions better. And there's no doubt that training to be creative affects the way the brain is able to be creative. You know, it's not just that you're born an artist or you're not. I mean, people that have been able to improvise at this level, they're so trained that they can enter this kind of creative mode really at the flip of a switch in jazz. And so that, I think, is a remarkable idea, that you can train your brain to do these things. It's not just a fixed quantity or a fixed capacity that you are born with.
That's great. We're going to take a break in a short moment. David Cho, would you like to weigh in on this before we break?
I have become quite an expert on brain training. In the last few years, I had a very serious brain injury caused by viral encephalitis, caused by a viral infection, and sort of went into a black tunnel. And the coming out of that tunnel and sort of regaining cognitive function, including creativity, took a lot of proved to me the point you've made, Dr. Lim, about plasticity. It wasn't at all obvious that recovering from that was possible. But through music, through many different kinds of cognitive therapy, I feel like my brain training has been successful.
Yeah. We have a caller on the line. We'll hear from Bill in just a moment, and I think he's going to continue the conversation to your point, David Shaw, and also Dr. Lim. We're going to take a quick break in the meantime. When we come back, your comments and questions. Please stay with us. This is Maine Calling.
News happens. It can be anywhere.
To dissolve the Constitution on a temporary basis.
On PRI's The World, we look for second opinions, unusual angles.
No, you cannot do that. This is democracy.
We help you think through the day's events.
There's no question that what the violence that we saw overnight is a step in the wrong direction.
PRI's The World. It's your world.
Join us for The World this afternoon at 3 o'clock.
What's going on in your brain while you sleep, and how can you make sure you get the sleep you need? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with neuroscientist Penelope Lewis, author of The Secret World of Sleep. She runs the Sleep and Memory Lab at the University of Manchester in England. Join us.
Join us at 7 o'clock for Fresh Air. Broadcast of Maine Calling is made possible by you, our MPBN listeners, and by the Maine Community Foundation, working with donors and other partners to strengthen Maine's economy and communities on the web at mainecf.org, and by Maine Farmland Trust, presenting Maine Fair, a celebration of local food and farming, September 6th and 7th in Belfast, maine-fair.org.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Suzanne Nance, and today on the program, understanding creativity and its importance, not just in the arts, but in the workplace as well. With me in the studio, Jennifer Torrance, Jackson Laboratories Senior Manager of Multimedia Services. She's also an accomplished singer. David Shaw, he's founder of IDEX Laboratories and a life trustee of the Jackson Laboratory. He's also former chairman of its board of trustees. And on the line with us from his office is Dr. Charles Lim. He's Associate Professor of Otolaryngology at the Johns Hopkins University. He's also on the faculty at the Peabody Conservatory of Music. We'd love for you to join the conversation. Have you found a way to get your creative juices flowing? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, that's 1-800-399-3566. You can email talk@mpbn.net, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. So what can one do to inspire creativity in one's daily life?
I'd be happy to take a shot at that. I think for in business, a constant inspiration for creativity is being the best in the world at meeting customer needs. And in a sea of competitors, typically all anyone in business has competitors. If you decide you want to be the very best at what you do, it's a constant source of creativity to understand and have customer insight that's better than anyone else's and try to respond to that. Sometimes doing things that seem almost impossible, but you can make possible through creativity.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. We've got Bill in Bath. The phones are lighting up. So let's hear from Bill. He's been on the line for a while. Hi, Bill. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Oh, great. Great to be connected to Maine Calling.
It's great to have you.
Yeah, fascinating topic. You're talking about the world I ended up being thrust into.
Go ahead. Tell us a little bit.
That are being made. Wow.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us a little bit about your experience.
Meningitis as a toddler then left me with decades and decades of epilepsy. Hmm. And then finally, 5 years ago, the surgery that fixed the right hemisphere of my brain that allowed me to survive, but it unleashed the right side, and I was transformed from an engineer and a scientist into a poet and a feeler. And the connection with David Shaw is I'm one of Tom Payment's mentors, and we discuss stuff. And Louis Stanislaw invited you guys to the pre-release screening of On the Edge, which I'm the guy with epilepsy from.
That's so great. Well, I'm glad that you're able to call in and be a part of the conversation. Dr. Lim, perhaps this speaks to that creative expression location in the brain. Could you weigh in on Bill's comment?
I can try to. First of all, it's a remarkable story, Bill, and thank you for sharing that. Now, there are so many kind of anecdotal case reports of people who underwent what was, you know, by all accounts, a bad thing neurologically, meaning something that was an accident or a disease or trauma, and wound up changed. And in several of these accounts, I would encourage you to read Musicophilia by Oliver Sacks if you haven't. There are these people that talk about, in a sense, unleashing of creative activities, or all of a sudden a new person is emerging where there used to just be a shell of that person. I think that it's safe to say that we haven't figured out what really takes place in these kinds of things. And there's probably not just one answer, but what it is suggesting to me very clearly, and this is, I think, the take-home point, your brain is the source of these things. And when we are affecting the brain, for example, in a surgery or in a stroke or in epilepsy, we are changing its function and therefore behavior. And so there's this clear link between one's creative behavior and their brain activity. And so I think it's suggesting that we need to look back at the neurobiology of these things if we really want to understand what's happening.
Yeah. Let's go to Don in East Booth Bay. He is a painter and would like to weigh in on the subject. Hi, Don.
Oh, I'm here.
Hi. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Well, glad to be here.
Yeah, go ahead. So you're a painter, and you've been researching what leads to creativity. Tell us about what you've been experiencing.
Okay, well, I've been a painter all my life, and for many years doing really lousy works. And then as I got older and I figured out certain things worked and certain things didn't, and eventually my batting average got so high that I figured, hey, I think I've got this thing figured out. And it involves tuning into a creative part of your mind, which requires some it's just as important out the other parts of your mind which are interfering with that. And I, when I decided that I really had to figure it out, I wrote a book. And, of course, this is a shameless plug for my book, but I'd like people to look at it. It gives a series of pointers, what you do, what you think, what you don't think when you're trying to do a work of art.
Can you give us the top example there?
Well, it's a 50-page book. About half of it is examples of artwork, and the rest. It's too long to summarize. Say the whole thing. But let me just say, there's a cliche in artwork that you let the paintings talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fundamental. But of course, that's much too simple. There's a whole lot of pages that tell you how to get into that state and what you have to do and what you have to not do. And if I'm allowed to, I'd like to just give people a link to where they can get this book if they would like to explore these ideas themselves.
Okay. Can you post it on our Facebook page so folks can have a reference for it?
I can tell you on the phone, and I can get to your Facebook page.
All right, go ahead.
My website is dilworthart.com. My name is D-I-L-W-O-R-T-H.
That's great.
Dilworthart.com. And right at the top of that page, you'll see a link to the book, which is called Impressionism Today.
Terrific. Thank you, Don.
Okay. And if anyone can read that and leave comments or let me know what they think about it, I would really appreciate it.
That's terrific. They can continue the conversation. Thanks, Don.
I'd love to make a comment about something Don just said, the fact that you have to consciously tune out the non-creative influences in order to be able to reach that state of creativity. I think that's really important to note in business. And so much of what we do in our work day, in our work environment, is so transactional and so, you're going from one thing to another. And it is very hard to get into that state of creative flow. And I think you need to make time, both in personal life and in business, for people to achieve that state. It really makes a big difference. It's very hard to get into that state of flow if you are moving from one thing to the next in quick, rapid succession. So I think that's a great point.
Yeah, and what struck me as interesting in Don's statement was that he talked about being a lousy painter for so long, and then he, you know, was able to garner this experience and feel good about his work. And Dr. Lim, you touched on this as well, that the improvisation allows you to make mistakes a little bit. So, David Shaw, I'm wondering about in the business world, if we apply this idea of allowing one to make mistakes, allowing one to fail, how does a director feel about that? Obviously, you want success. You need to, you want success in the business. But if there's this opportunity for failure, sometimes success can occur.
Yeah, I think in great businesses you have to tolerate a certain amount of failure, risk-taking, and chaos, frankly. Thomas Edison once said, "I failed my way to success." And it's often that we all learn the most from our failures, and then those failures, the learnings from those failures and the mindset and the spirit associated with that can drive to success. I would just add, I'm sorry to be quoting people here, but Picasso said, "To draw, you must close your eyes and sing," and it sort of speaks to that, to that getting out of the immediacy of things that you're dealing with and trying to process it in a different way.
Right, get out of your own way. That's great. Let's go to Robert in Bar Harbor. He is interested in the process of the right brain and working on a novel. Hi, Robert.
Yes. First of all, I want to thank Suzanne Nance for all her wonderful sharing of music for so long on MPBN. And I understand you're going to move away from that. And it's been invaluable to me in a project I've been working on 9 years. 9 years ago, I didn't know if it was going to be my last project because I was overcoming cancer then.
Mm-hmm.
And I have overcome that, but now I'm faced with another very grave illness. And this project is a fiction. It's a novel. The protagonist is a child because it involves what's going to happen to our children, and the overriding theme of it is the climate crisis and the gravity of what we face as a nation if we don't turn this around, and for future generations in particular. And I am nearing the completion of this novel, and I am not particularly knowledgeable or how to begin to get peer review. I need peer review, and I'm very close to having it at a point where I could give it to somebody to read and get that peer review.
It certainly sounds like an interesting project, and you are tapping into the creative side of your brain to obviously write the novel and share some information. So I really appreciate you weighing into the conversation and sharing your experience. And thanks also for your kind words, Robert. Good luck with the novel.
You know, I just had an idea because one of the things that has been so valuable about the Right Brain Cafe at the Jackson Laboratory is that it is a place in time where people can come and do exactly what you are suggesting. You're looking for peer review. And in Bar Harbor, you know, if you could tap into the local community and maybe post some bulletins and, you know, set a time, set a space, choose a location, go to the Opera House Cafe or whatever and say, I'm going to be here during this period of time, and just see who comes and share your work with them and get their feedback. You know, make it happen. You need to take responsibility for making that happen. If you don't do it, no one else will. So create a time and a space, allow people to come to you, and just take their feedback.
Create your own Right Brain Cafe.
Absolutely.
We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. In fact, we have Alex on the line from Falmouth who has a question for Dr. Lim. We'll hear from Alex in just a moment. Please stay with us.
Imagine there's a way to hack into your brain to rewire it, to make you smarter, even happier.
Altering cognitive abilities, altering personality is within our reach now.
It's like science fiction.
It's mapping an unexplored universe.
I'm Guy Raz. The hackers are coming for your brain, the climate, even the animal kingdom on the next TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And you can hear that TED Radio Hour program this afternoon following Main Calling at 1 o'clock. If you're a regular MPBN listener, you've heard the following phrase more than once. Support for MPBN is made possible in part by, and then the names of local businesses and organizations. These groups know well the value of MPBN in our community, the benefit of associating with our programming, and reaching you, the statewide public radio audience. They chose again and again to make public radio and television part of their annual marketing effort. If you would like to learn more, please visit mpbn.net and click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information, or you can call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. Thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine.
And welcome back. I'm Suzanne Nance, and you're listening to Maine Calling here on MPBN. Today, we're discussing creativity, what science is learning about which parts of our brain are the creative centers, and how some businesses and business leaders are fostering creativity in the workplace. With me in the studio, Jennifer Torrance. She works at Jackson Laboratories and is also a singer. David Scholl is the founder of IDEX Laboratory. He, last year, won, along with his wife, the first ever Maine Creative Industries Award for their extraordinary ability to blend creativity in art and business. Also joining us from his office in Baltimore is Dr. Charles Lim, Associate Professor of Otolaryngology at the Johns Hopkins University. He's also on the faculty at the Peabody Conservatory of Music. Let's go right back to the phones. I want to give the phone number for those of you who are interested in calling in, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Hi, Alex. Welcome to Maine Calling.
Hi.
Thanks for calling in today.
Thanks.
I understand you have a question for Dr. Lim.
Yes, I did. I was really interested in what he had to say because I'm a jazz pianist and also potential neuroscience major in college, so I was just really interested in some of the stuff he was saying about trying to measure the actual biological mechanisms behind something like creativity. And so I was just wondering, with something as sort of as a fuzzy abstract concept as creativity, how is there research being done, or what are you doing to try to quantify or measure quantitatively something like creativity other than comparing the brains of people improvising versus playing rehearsed music or something like that. And especially in musical creativity, I was wondering what kind of quantitative research is being done.
Yeah, Dr. Lim?
Sure. Thank you, Alex. And let me say good luck on your pathway. There is definitely a role for jazz musicians in neuroscience, okay? Absolutely. We need more jazz musicians in neuroscience because I think jazz musicians understand that improvisation is a different way of thinking. So to answer your question, there are a lot of ways to study creativity. Some are neuroscientific, some are psychological, some are social, some are educational. What I try to do is use basic core neuroscience methods. The one that I'm using most commonly now is functional MRI. And this is a modification of traditional MRI that allows you to use blood flow patterns in the brain to see which neurons were active. It's a really interesting method because you can do almost any task in the brain scanner as long as your head is relatively still. And so we have professional musicians doing all manner of musical tasks. We do have a lot of jazz musicians that are improvising, but for example, we'll have rappers that are freestyling in there. We'll have visual artists that are drawing in there. And what we're trying to do is to separate out or control for the conditions that or the aspects of creative behavior that are not necessarily creative. And so what I mean by that is, and you know very well, when you sit down and play the piano, there's a certain neurobiology associated with just sitting down to play the piano, even if you're just playing Twinkle Twinkle. And you want to, in a sense, not confuse or conflate those findings with the ones that are active when you're taking a solo. And so to try to isolate the mechanisms of creativity, we control for things pretty carefully so we can have measurements that pertain really to the creative act.
Does that answer your question, Alex?
Yeah, that was great. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for calling in.
This is David. I'd love to add to people's appreciation of the amazing creativity of some musicians. And I lost most of my right brain function with encephalitis, and I was encouraged to take up music. And I've become the worst drummer in Southern Maine in the past year.
How has that helped you rehabilitate?
but inspired. I'm at least in the band, and I play along with a lot of either live or recorded music, and it truly is an amazing cognitive therapy to wrap your brain around music.
That's a perfect lead-in for Margaret, who's in Yarmouth. She wants to talk about creativity and the brain as well. Hi, Margaret.
Thank you for answering my call. It's a fascinating show. I've heard your guests, and I'm a big Oliver Sacks reader, so I have been very interested in the creative process as a result of trauma or disease. I'm wondering about the other side of creativity and creativity, a burst of creativity being a precursor to dementia. My father died many years ago of Pick's disease, which is prefrontal lobe dementia. He was a young man in his early 60s. It was just a nightmare, horrible disease. But I got very interested in the brain and began reading quite a bit. And I remember there was a JAMA article, or could have been one of the neurological journals, where I read a case study of a man on the West Coast, a painter, and he had this burst of creativity. Nobody knew why, but he was actually in the early stages of dementia and later went into a full dementia and was still painting, although I don't think his thoughts were as organized. I know it's probably overstating it to say a burst of creativity could be indicative of a dementia, but is there something about dementia that uninhibits or disinhibits people so they could actually become more creative? Does that make sense?
Well, thank you, Margaret. And I don't want to put Dr. Lim on the spot. He's an otolaryngologist and a surgeon who's done this research on improv in the brain. But Dr. Lim, would you like to weigh in on that?
Definitely. That's a complicated situation. I think this idea of dementia and the prefrontal cortex, it really links to a much larger issue, which is that brain pathology has always been linked to art. And I mean that both in, if you look at the history of art, both psychological diseases, psychiatric diseases, and also organic diseases and head trauma, it's always been linked to changes in art. And so some of the most creative periods or art artworks that were ever created were done by people who were sick individuals. I mean, they were not able to function well in society, yet they were able to produce remarkable art. And this is, I think, again, linked to the idea of the prefrontal cortex as kind of a control center. In dementia, you're losing some of these control centers for sure. In fact, I mean, taken to the extreme, you can't function at all. And it's not so surprising that the loosening the reins on these control centers would, so to speak, disinhibit you, or at least take away some of the constraints that are internally imposed by most non-creative people as they contemplate creative tasks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Margaret, and also thank you, Dr. Lim. Here's a question that came in via Facebook. Do you think creativity is a product of upbringing and exposure to a creative environment, or is it something you're born with in your brain? And I'll throw that out to the panel. Hmm.
Wow, that's a great question.
Are you born with it, or is it exposure to creativity?
I think it's exposure. It doesn't matter what where you grow up or what socioeconomic background you're from. I think, you know, if you look at great creative artists, they come from everywhere. And, you know, myself, I mean, I've only recently now, I'm in my 40s, started to explore different creative sides. I have a degree in music, but those years in music school were some of the least creative that I've had. I don't think it really matters where you come from. I think it's exposure. You know, listen, now we have YouTube. You know, you can go online and you can see these amazing performances that can give you inspiration. And, you know, the more you listen, I mean, I think it really is, it's exposure. I don't think you're born with it.
Yeah, I think there's no question that speaking a little bit about the Jackson Laboratory and genetics, there's no question that there are some genetic behavioral traits that predispose people to different kinds of personalities and traits and so forth. But the ability of the environment, this is a nature or nurture issue, the ability to nurture those very dramatically through your environment is very clear.
Mm-hmm. David Shaw, you are surrounded by creative people. You're highly creative. You're creative yourself. We've had offline conversations. What do you notice in the creative people that you surround yourself with as common traits, if any?
Well, I think we've talked about some of them, the ability to unleash creativity by overcoming inhibitions is very important. So to sort of have the attitude, the mindset that the conventional wisdom is wrong and to also seek out new perspectives. So to consciously try to interact with people with many different perspectives and then to sometimes synthesize those perspectives. So I think it can be a very intentional exercise.
That's great. I'd like to thank our guests this morning, Jennifer Torrence, David Shaw, and Dr. Charles Lim. Thank you all for joining us today. Jennifer Torrence is Jackson Laboratories' Senior Manager of Multimedia Services, David Shaw, the founder of IDEX Laboratories, and Dr. Charles Lim, an Associate Professor of Otolaryngology at the Johns Hopkins University. Thank you all. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. Volunteer Cindy Hahn answered your calls, and John Keimel ran the board. We also had help from the MPBN web team. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our podcast by visiting mpbn.net/Maine Calling. Again, visit our Facebook page, Maine Calling on Facebook, and become a part of the conversation. I'm Suzanne Nance. Thanks so much for joining us.